Going to turn back to Romans chapter 11. We're picking up in verse 19. Those of you who may not have been with us for a while or even missed a week, Paul is entertaining the question, is God done with Israel? Is it just the church now? And I apologize, I know this is repetition for some, but I think it's worth saying. One of the things that we haven't really thought about in regards to this discussion, though, and it's very important, is that in asking the question, there's another question that is embedded in it that we haven't entertained yet. For those of you who haven't been here, let me just give you the quick answer. The answer is no, God is not done with Israel. And remember, the whole discussion started on the heels of Paul declaring God's steadfast love for his people. And primarily, Paul is speaking of God's love for those who are in Christ Jesus, but he anticipated those who are going to take that statement and say, well, wait a minute, God loved these people, but now he's not working with them, he's working with the church. Does that mean he doesn't love them? Does that mean he's done with them? And secondly, what are the implications for the church? And when you go beyond that point, if the question has come up, wait a minute, has God changed? And that's the question we really haven't entertained. And it's a sobering question when you think about it. You know, change is never easy. I think I've shared with you before that when I was graduating from college, the speaker was Warren Wiersbe. And I remember most of his outline, but the thing that I really remember the most was when he stood up and he says, he was talking about Peter, and the question was, how do you handle change? And he says, you know, we've never done it that way. Those are usually the seven last words of the church. And then he diverted, he goes, by the way, do you know how many church members it takes to change a light bulb? And some of you already know the answer to this. For those of you who don't, he said, the answer is change. Who said anything about change? My grandmother gave that light bulb to the church. I just, you know, it's not just change that's difficult for people. It turns out it's difficult for animals. We discovered this last night. Jill and I, after almost 26 years of marriage, we made a major change in our household. We went from a quilt to a fleecy kind of thing on our bed. And the cats jumped up on it and just were terrified. They like it now, and more's the pity as far as I'm concerned, because they want to spend time on it. You know, and these are funny things. But think about it for just a minute. Because what are the eternal implications if God could change? It's sobering. And that's why it's so important that we answer this question. And the question that has been being answered throughout the text is, no, God has not changed, but he's changing people so that he can bless them again. You know, and this is one of the reasons I get so upset with people love that song, God Bless America. And I keep saying, no, God, make America blessable. I wish I could write a song because that would be it. You know, make us blessable again. Change us so that we could enjoy your favor. And throughout this whole passage, he's been talking about how because Israel sinned, God dealt with them and punished them, set them aside, is now working with the church. But those who are in the church run the risk of becoming too secure in that place. And that's kind of where we left it off and where we're going to pick it up. Because in verse 19, we get to the second imperative that is a part of this. And for those of you who are just jumping in, let me just really quickly, and this is in your bulletin outline. Last week we looked at God's inclusion of the Gentiles. God has included the Gentiles because of the Jews' sin. We looked at how this inclusion opened up the door to salvation to more people. And there was a reminder in this first section and also in the second one is that God is using this ministry to the Gentiles and he's going to awaken a hunger for God in the hearts of the Jewish people. And they're going to return to him, and they'll be restored. And as they're restored, more Gentiles are going to want to be saved. And so all of these things are happening to draw people to themselves. God's intention was that we get the attention of Israel, and we become a tool. And then that ended with three imperatives. I'd like to read verses 17 through 24. These are all three of the commands that are given. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches if you are. Remember, it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will He spare you. Note then the kindness and the severity of God. Severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in His kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. And they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in. For God who has power to graft them in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you were cut from that which is by nature a wild olive tree, and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, the natural branches, be grafted back into their own olive tree? And so he's using this illustration of grafting to show how God cut off branches and then grafted other ones in. And we noticed last week that God was cutting off cultivated branches and he was grafting in the Gentiles, which were the wild branches. You didn't do that. Because if you cultivated wild branches into a bad tree or into a good tree, the result would normally be bad fruit coming from a good tree. But God, who is able to do all things, it's kind of interesting. It makes reference to God who even brings the dead back to life. I think that really speaks to the power it takes to change us. Has grafted these wild branches into a good stump. And somehow good fruit came from it because of the power of God. And it's kind of interesting because when you get into the first imperative was don't become arrogant. The second imperative is going to be very similar, but he starts with the premise, and that is this. He's saying, my headset broke, so we're having to do this, and I keep bumping it. He starts with the premise, and that is, there's going to be a temptation for some of you who are Gentiles to say, well, wait a minute, they were cut off so I could be grafted in. And remember, the warning was, don't be arrogant. But the natural response of most people is to feel pretty privileged, and to feel pretty privileged makes you to feel very arrogant. You know, when I was in high school, I was cut from virtually every team I tried to be a part of, except soccer. Two reasons why I wasn't cut from soccer. One is we really needed the people. The other is, it turns out that it was kind of new to us. I know this sounds foreign in this day and age, but back then soccer was kind of a new game, and all of us were kind of equally uncoordinated with our feet. And we had our very first soccer game, and it turned out I almost kind of excelled in it, which was a major change from always being dropped. And so I'm running, and at halftime, I don't know if you remember this, Dad, but kind of basking in the moment of feeling good about my accomplishments. And Dad came over and he put his arm around me. He says, you're really doing well out there. I'm really proud of you. Thanks. And I ran off and I fell right on my face because I tripped on my own feet. Pride breeds carelessness. Privilege produces arrogance. And so we start with the premise where some of us might be tempted to just think a lot more of ourselves than what we ought to think. And then there's a principle where he says, you know, okay, I guess you could say that's true. And I get the feeling that, and again, this is, I feel like I'd need about 8 more years of Greek study to really say this emphatically. But as I read this, the impression I get is Paul saying, okay, you could make that argument. And that's when he says that is true. But here's the dominant force. Or the dominant phrase is, the real principle here is that unbelief is what caused their separation. In other words, if Israel had stayed faithful, they never would have been severed. But it was their unfaithfulness that caused them to be placed to the side. And then he goes on, he makes another point, where he goes, but you need to remember something. You're only really connected as long as you're walking and living by faith. Now, this has been taken a couple of directions that I believe are very unfortunate. Sometimes this has been used as an argument against the security of the believer, and I don't think that's where this is going. I think what Paul is talking about is that the same God who took sin very seriously during the time of Israel still takes sin seriously during the age of the church. And I think sometimes we forget that. And here's why I think we forget that. And I've even heard people say, I don't like the God of the Old Testament, but the God of the New Testament, He's nice. It's the same God. But He was revealing Himself so powerfully, and to whom much is given, much is expected. And I believe that's why we see the judgments that were more severe and more swift. In this day and age, we don't see the pillar of fire. We don't see the cloud. We don't have people being brought back from the dead on a regular basis. And we don't have the prophets that wield the authority like in Elijah or Moses or some of these other people who are doing spectacular signs to authenticate. God is ministering through people in the power of the Holy Spirit. But I believe because it is, and I hate to use this word, maybe a little bit more subtle in terms of arresting attention, that is why we see the judgments coming slower and less severe. I wish... Well, it's the mathematician in me. However, and again, if you've been here a while, you know this. Discipline is never an option for the believer. It comes in two forms. One is what we would call self-discipline. However, can I just... Really quickly, later we're going to read from John chapter 15. And John 15 states very emphatically that apart from Jesus Christ, we can do nothing. So really what self-discipline is the change that God is making in me because I bring nothing good in myself. And I am able to obey Him out of His strength flowing in and through me. And so really when you think about it, self-discipline is God's strength being manifest. When we do not yield to God, then divine discipline becomes a mandate. And this, the primary text for that is in the book of Hebrews chapter 12. Another place where you can see this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where Paul is talking about the communion table and how some took this table and they made a mockery out of it. And Paul makes the statement that some are even weak and have fallen asleep. Because they've made such a mockery and been so sinful in the presence of the Lord, in the Lord's table, observing communion. And the idea here is that because of constant sin, some have become sick. And some, it uses the phrase falling asleep, but that's a euphemism. It means they've died because they've made such a mockery of this. First John chapter 5 talks about that the ones who are in unrepentant sin. And Paul talks about how there is a sin that is leading unto death in the unrepentant sin. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul's talking about a believer who is living in sin. And instead of the church rushing to him and confronting him in his sin, they're applauding and saying, oh, look how open-minded we are. Sounds scarily, eerily similar to what happens today, does it not? Look how open-minded we are. And Paul's saying, no, you should confront them. In fact, I am praying for the destruction of their flesh. In other words, I'm praying for their death so they do not live beyond the realm of God's mercy. Others have taken this to mean, okay, God's talking about removing the branches. So, okay, He removed Israel and He's going to remove the church and there's got to be something else, right? No, that's not where He's going with this. I believe very firmly He's talking about individuals. Folks, there is no anything else. There is Israel, and there is the church. And by the way, God has promised that He will build His church, and not even the gates of hell will prevail against it. We're not talking about numerical. We're talking about a people who are purified and redeemed and living for the glory of God. Ephesians chapter 5, Paul is talking about marriage, but he says, you know, marriage is like this. It's like God who's going to present the church as the bride, spotless and without wrinkle. Jude 24 and 25, to Him who is able to present you before the throne, blameless. Okay, so there was Israel, there is the church, and when the church is caught up to be with the Lord Jesus Christ, then the focus will go back to Israel. But there is no plan C. I've seen that read into this several times, and I just want to get that off my chest. He's talking about dealing with individuals who were in sin. And by the way, one of the main arguments I often hear toward those who would say that this is a blow against the doctrine of eternal security, or that once you are saved, you cannot lose that salvation. I just want to say this, that if you are teaching that you can be saved and live any way that you want to, you are not teaching salvation correctly. Salvation demands fruit. So here are the precepts. Imperative one, don't be arrogant. Imperative number two, develop an awe of God. Now, he repeats the first command, so do not become proud. Almost a direct repetition, a little bit different form, but same root. So don't become proud, but instead, what you need to do is you need to fear God. And we talked a lot about the fear of God when we were back in Romans chapter 3, and I do not want to repeat all those again. But sometimes a question comes up, how do I develop a fear of God? Would you turn to Proverbs chapter 2 for just a moment? This has become my favorite new passage on how you become a person who fears God. Proverbs chapter 2. We'll start with verse 1. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. Yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of God, the Lord, and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield for those who walk in integrity, guarding over the paths of justice and watching over the way of His saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice with equity in every good path. And it goes on from there. There's too many benefits for us to read the whole thing this morning, especially since I do want to make sure that you have time for testimonies. But do you realize what he's saying here? If you want to know how to fear God, here's what you do. You give very strict attention to His Word. And you make wisdom your pursuit. Because if you desire God's wisdom more than anything, there's only one place from which you can get it. The more you're in His Word, the more you get as much of a glimpse as we can with human eyes of how great and mighty and holy our God is. And the more you understand about His greatness as it's revealed to us in His Word, the more we understand our frailty and our helplessness, and the more we are just in awe of Him. And so if you want to develop a fear of God, you love His Word. And then secondly, He says there's one other thing you have to do, and that is that you have to cry out for it. In other words, you have to pray. James chapter 1, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him do what? Let him ask of God. And I love it. My translation says, because God gives liberally, generously, as long as you ask in faith, with nothing doubting. For the one who doubts is like the wave of the oceans that are just tossed about to and fro. You want to know the fear of God? You pursue His Word. And you cry out for it in prayer. I love the imagery that goes in verse 4, especially because it uses pirate language. And I don't know, I've always been kind of fascinated by pirates. But generally speaking, what's the attitude of a pirate where gold is concerned? Hadn't thought of that term, but yeah, you're right. It's good theology, whoever that was. Strong desire. They will do anything to find that wealth, whether it means hurting another or you know, you get all the piratey things that go on, right? That same desire, not the same actions, but the same desire is to be the one that we have. We should desire wisdom more than anything. And he says, if you do that, then God will reveal to you what the fear of the Lord is. And so it's an amazing thing. The more we look into His Word, the more that He gives it to us. And again, in verse 21, there's just a reminder of that principle that came out in verse 20, which is that if God didn't spare the natural branches, He will not spare you either. In other words, remember, God still deals with sin in the lives of His people. And no, He's not going to set aside Israel, or He's not going to set aside the church for some other entity. He will deal with you. Imperative number three. This time you get the precept right up front. Deliberate on God's attributes. In verse 23, or 22 rather, note then the kindness and the severity of God. I want to just stop there for just a moment. Let me define one quick term here. When we talk about an attribute, this is not the same thing as personality. Personalities change. Priorities change because personalities change. I was just thinking about this. The other day, I'd been away from home for a long time. And I realized, because I was thinking about how personalities change and attributes don't, how different I am from what I used to be. There was a point in my life where after a long trip in the home, away from home, the very first thing I'd want to do is to get out my Lincoln Logs. I don't do that anymore. Now the first thing I do when I get home is check email. Substitute one toy for another, I guess. An attribute is an unchanging characteristic that is used to describe the very nature of our God, His unchanging nature. Let me give you a list of the primary attributes. There is love. There is mercy, kindness, omnipotence, which means that God is all-powerful, omnipresent, which means that God is everywhere present at the same time. You know, and it's been really twisted lately to where people say, well, I believe that God is everywhere, so God is this tree. No, that's not what it's saying. But that God is everywhere present. Psalm 139, where can I go from your presence? Nowhere. If I go up in the highest mountain, you're there. If I were to go to the depths of Sheol, you're right there. So He is everywhere present at the same time. Now, for a couple of you, I thought God was in heaven. Yet that's described as a place where His primary presence is manifest. But God is everywhere present at the same time. He's omniscient. He knows all things. He is holy. He is sovereign. Meaning that He is the ruler of this world and He is working His plan with absolute perfection. Nothing in this world happens save but by God's permission. He is immutable, meaning He does not change. He is just. He is eternal. He has always existed and He always will. And by the way, if you ever lose sight of the fear of God and just how wonderfully, spectacularly different He is from us or anything that we know, just try to think about the God who had no beginning. Sometimes I can almost wrap my head around never ending. But never beginning. And He knows the future. I mean, time is irrelevant to God. He invented it so we could measure things. But He knows the future as well as the past and the present. He is truth. Now, some of you may say, but there are other things. Like, isn't God patient? Yeah, He is. But that would be a reflection of His kindness and His mercy and love. And there are other things that we could say, but these are the primary attributes. I want you to notice a couple of things. First of all, is notice the demands of this command. In verse 22, that word note means to set your mind on, to dwell on, to think about this, to consider, to concentrate, to meditate, to keep thinking about this thing. And so He goes, I want you to keep thinking about who God is. Would you notice the diversity in this command? In that He says, I want you to remember two things about God. I want you to remember His kindness, but I also want you to remember His severity. And that is so important that we do not exalt one attribute of God at the expense or at the point of ignoring the other attributes of God. Because the minute we do that, we end up with a system that is idolatrous and sometimes heretical. Let me give you an example. You have someone who emphasizes that God is love. And they only emphasize the mercy, the kindness, and the love of God. And after a while they say, well, then there can't be any such thing as hell. Holiness. I mean, that's the attribute that's declared in heaven. And we could talk about His justice, but we also need to consider His compassion, because His holiness demands that we pay for sin, and that's why there is an eternal hell for those who die in their sin. But His compassion and His mercy and His kindness, that's what brought us the cross, so that Jesus Christ could die for our sins on the cross, that He could satisfy the wrath of God, and that God could forgive us without Himself becoming unjust. And so it's very important we remember all the attributes of God. Now, there may be seasons where you come up where you have a special need. I noticed when the David was in his sin, he dwelt for a time on the mercy of God. But all you have to do is to read the Psalms and to note that David never forgot about the holiness of God. But for a season, this one attribute became very precious to him. But not at the expense or ignoring the other attributes of God. He's calling us not just to think about the attributes of God that are fun because they're easy. He's calling us to consider all of the attributes of God because all of them describe who God is. In this case, I want you to remember His kindness, but I also want you to remember His severity. And that is that God, again, I know I've used this phrase a couple of times, but that God deals with those who have fallen into sin. And this is actually an act of love. And think about it. If there was no love from God, there would be no discipline. Because God is very clear. He only disciplines who? Those whom He loves. But it's not just constant kindness. Sometimes it is very severe correction. Because both are needed. So the precept. Deliberate on God's attributes. The demand is that we're constantly thinking. Note then. That word note means constantly remembering. Front of mind. The diversity. That we remember not just the fun things and the comforting. But we remind ourselves of the kindness and the severity of God. Notice the direction. The severity to those who have fallen, but kindness to you. Provided what? Provided that you stay in His kindness. In other words, this. If you obey God and you're living in obedience, you will still be overwhelmed at His greatness. But you do not have to fear His chastening hand. The only time you have to fear the chastening hand of God is if you step out of His will. And then He does it for the purpose of directing you back to His will. Why? This is the... what I call the desperation. But there's also hope here. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. In other words, there's life and death here. Sometimes. Not that God just rubs people out constantly or easily. But it has come to that point on occasion. And then this wonderful promise is that God has the power to graft Israel back in again. You know, and it's so interesting because here He's saying, you know what? It didn't make any sense for God to graft you in to His promises. But it makes more sense for Him to pick up the branches that He had cut off and put those back in the tree. Now again, in the world of biology, or botany, horticulture, this would make no sense. Once you cut off a limb, it was never for the purpose of reconnecting it. And yet Paul said, that's exactly what God is doing. He's cut them off. And one day He's going to reconnect them. And you think about it, well, they're dead. Yeah, but remember, earlier it says that God can bring the dead back to life. And so it's just this reminder that there's a time when God will reconnect them. But you need to remember, church, there is no place for pride in our lives. There is no place for us to be casual about personal sin. There is absolutely no cause for us to take apostasy in the church lightly. God deals with those individuals and institutions that go that way. You look at the book of Revelation, starting with the very first church, the church at Ephesus. And God makes the promise, listen, you need to get right with me or I will snuff you out. In other words, I will end that church. Saw a really sad sign yesterday. We were out and about in some really weird places. Thanks, Siri. And we went by a church. They had a sign that says church for lease. And you're thinking, well, maybe they grew and they just can't fit in that building anymore. But unfortunately, I hear about more and more churches that are just completely going out of business. And I say unfortunate because I think it's unfortunate that they got to that point, but I believe a lot of it is a reflection of divine judgment. You weren't true to the word, you weren't true to me, that church is gone. But again, it just ends with this reminder that God is going to graft the natural branches in. He can and He will. This week in preparation for communion, I was just reading from John and chapter 15. Jesus says this, I am the true vine and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, He takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, He prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you. As the branches cannot bear fruit by itself, unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, and whatever you wish for will be done for you. For by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father loves me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that your joy may be full, and that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. You know, you look at this wonderful passage where Jesus is talking about the importance of dwelling closely to Him. And He makes some very important points, and that is that if you really are connected to me, you will bear fruit. But if you're bearing fruit, you'll be pruned so that you can bear more fruit. If you're not bearing fruit, well, then you'll just be severed and put off to the side. And again, I don't think this is a security verse. I think it's just an analogy. That's what they did in Paul's day. They cut off unproductive branches and they burned them. Paul, Jesus is speaking here, I'm sorry. But it's the importance of dwelling close to God so that you can be productive for His glory, because His disciples are known by bearing fruit. If we're not bearing fruit, we're not identifiable as a disciple. In fact, very well may not be. But it's just, again, this wonderful picture of God using the agricultural world to show us the importance of staying close to Him. Staying humble. Being productive for His glory. And staying righteous. Let's take a few moments and, boy, I didn't want to talk this long, but it's a loaded passage. But let's take a few moments, and men that are preparing communion, musicians, would you come down at this time? And we mentioned earlier, we